Good afternoon, everybody. Shaul Plasser coming at you live from my house back in Cincinnati. Thank God, I had a beautiful day yesterday in Chicago. Dropped off my daughter and her friend at my mother-in-law's. They could spend a week doing a writing workshop program. Then I stayed safely in West Rogers Park, not going anywhere near the Democrat National Convention and its professional agitators and communists. A Dobbins and eight locally in the Jewish neighborhood, and then skedaddled out of there. Thank God, with my safety intact. And here we are, back in Cincy. And we're going to do chapter 4, and maybe even chapter 5 in our book, Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain, Rabbi Hanan Balk. This is our book club book choice, and we're enjoying it very much, at least I am. So chapter 4, The Huddle, page 103. Behold how good and pleasant it is for brothers to sit together. Hine matov umanoim sheves achim gam yachai. Psalm 133, page 104. Beloved colleagues, I cannot emphasize enough the wonderful relationships I developed with the staff members of the hospital. They welcomed me not only as a colleague, but as a cherished friend, and even as a member of the hospital family. First and foremost, the people with whom I spent the most time were my fellow chaplains and those who worked in the pastoral care office. Slowly, the connection I had with the priests, ministers, and our administrative assistant developed from one based on mutual respect to a deep, abiding friendship. Truth be told, during my 1.5-year training period, these relationships were almost completely professional. As a student, I was not yet at the level of comfort that the open sharing of thoughts and feelings requires. Part of this was no doubt a sense of fear I still had when engaging with either my CPE supervisor, who demanded, and rightfully so, dedication to the role of the chaplain, or the director of pastoral care, who came off as very stern and authoritative. That all started to change following the completion of my CPE studies, when I was asked to become an unofficial member of the staff. I say unofficial because the pastoral care director thought I would be a great addition, but there was no position available at the time. This offer followed a precedent that had been established to bring on another chaplain 18 years prior, who raised his own salary from his particular religious denomination. Thus, I was engaged as the Jewish community chaplain and raised my own funds. Fundraising was a vital part of my previous rabbinic position. There was an expectation, though not a guarantee, that should a position become available, I would be a primary candidate. And that suited me fine. Now that I was considered a member of the staff who worked together daily with the pastoral care team, the relationships flourished and were even more intensely crystallized when the hospital leadership requested all units begin to meet daily to discuss the challenges, failures, and successes they had experienced. While I cannot say how this mandate affected the remainder of the hospital staff, with regard to the pastoral care team, the results were greater than I believe any of us could have imagined, as we shared the deepest and most important encounters of our day and offered constructive comments upon them, from which we all might learn. But perhaps most significantly, at the center of every day, in an atmosphere that can be filled with tragedy, death, and grief, we made time for humor and the ability to laugh with each other, and yes, even at each other. In short, we found joy in the midst of this brief respite from our otherwise intense experiences, which I have no doubt served to refresh our souls as we returned to face the challenges that lay before us. This daily gathering, which brought together individuals of disparate spiritual backgrounds, whose common purpose was to serve those in need of healing and to do so as messengers of God, armed with love and spirituality, was given a name, The Huddle, page 106, A Time to Share. It is amazing what a little bit of time of true focus can accomplish. A well-known scholar once commented with regard to marriage, share your days with each other, and you will share your lives. That was written by Beryl Wine. He argued that a husband and wife should share what each had experienced that day, if only for a few minutes, to create togetherness, an opportunity to connect on a regular basis, instead of merely passing by each other under the same roof and living in two separate worlds that never meet. A huddle seeks to create a similar bond between employees who, due to their hectic schedules, may become so absorbed with their duties that they fail to work together as a team with a shared set of goals. A typical huddle would begin with the director of pastoral services asking how everyone's day had gone, and then those who had more interesting encounters sharing them with the group. Invariably, I had the most to say, probably because as a former congregational rabbi who looked for sermons in my interactions, quote, around every corner, end quote, I reflected upon any unusual element in any visit that could somehow serve as the teaching moment. Soon I would come in with a list of written comments to contribute, the only one to do so, and it became almost ritualized that I would wait to speak until everyone else had their say, whereupon, after a brief period of silence, which indicated that all were finished, their eyes would turn to me as if to say, okay, Rabbi, what do you got? What I had were most of the patient encounters that were later used to form this book. Indeed, the huddle was an alternative title that I considered for this book because it was in that setting that these reflections were shared for the first time. I would share a patient encounter, often humorous, reflect, and bring a lesson from one of the myriad of rabbis that have authored works on topics of a religious and spiritual nature throughout Jewish history. Every time I made reference to a particular rabbi and identified him by name, our administrative assistant would laugh at how many rabbis, insights, and stories were available to me. She thought it to be incredible. Our director would sometimes comment after I had brought the teaching of a particular rabbi, you know, another rabbi used to say what you have stated in a somewhat different way. The first time he said this, I was obviously dismayed. Another rabbi? I asked. I was not aware that you were familiar with the many rabbis of Jewish tradition. To what rabbi are you referring? Smiles and laughter came to the faces of my colleagues until after a lengthy pause, I finally got it. Oh, that other rabbi whose teachings led to the founding of Christianity. These interchanges took place with a remarkable sense of respect, collegiality, and most of all, joy. Top of 108. Yes, amidst some of the deepest discussions I have ever witnessed, we found tremendous joy in the unique perspectives each of us brought to the table from our own backgrounds, thus creating a rarefied spiritual atmosphere I doubt could be replicated in many places, if at all. It would become customary for someone to offer a prayer at the end of the session for those patients we had discussed and others, including staff, whom we knew were ill. We would also pray for each other, learning over time of each other's family or life challenges, and thereby lending much-needed spiritual support to the very chaplain crew, which was so busy doing this for hundreds of others every day. This was in itself a tremendous boost, knowing how much each one of us cared and prayed for one another. Top page 109. One decision that the huddle made with regard to prayer, which I now take for granted, was very important to me. I told the group I understood that if one of them would offer the prayer, it would most likely end with, quote, we ask this in Jesus' name, amen, end quote. But I could not, in good conscience, remain in the room and share in the prayer if this reference was invoked. I also explained that I had no issue with leading prayer in a hospital room, with the patient chiming in with whatever additional elements from his Christian background he wished. That was his right. But in this case, as the prayer leader, was offering prayer for all of us, serving as my representative and invoking Jesus, I could not be authentically represented through such words. I offered to leave the room before the prayer, but my colleagues deemed this unnecessary. They agreed on the spot and without hesitation that as long as I was present, they would not pray in Jesus' name. This is a real shocker. I did not ask them to do that, and I certainly did not expect it. I was only explaining I could not be a part of it. In retrospect, this decision by my fellow chaplains was actually a reflection of the respect the chaplain is trained to have for the religious and social backgrounds of the patients. When I enter a room, I see before me one thing only, a person created in the image of God. I am concerned with that person's soul, his emotional and spiritual needs, as they present themselves in the here and now, in the same way that the medical team is focused on the patient's physical health, irrespective of his life choices. A chaplain attempts to allow another to be as comfortable as possible in his presence, without rendering any judgments, despite the fact that his personal views may greatly conflict with those held by the patient who is before him. My one and only concern is how I can relate to this person in such a way that I can provide healing from his spiritual suffering. Such a perspective is a basic foundation of the chaplain's code of ethics, a perspective which, if not properly upheld, could easily allow him to either not be aware of the suffering of another or to simply turn away from it. An illustration of which we may now turn. The Fall of Icarus, page 111. And here's a painting of the Fall of Icarus done by Peter Bruegel the Elder. One of my favorite paintings is the above work entitled The Fall of Icarus by Peter Bruegel the Elder, who lived 1525 to 1569. In other words, a very, very young man when he passed. Based upon a Greek myth, the story relates that in an effort to escape their imprisonment on the Isle of Crete, Daedalus, Icarus's father, creates wings of feathers held by wax to enable them to fly to freedom. Daedalus warns Icarus not to fly too close to the sun, lest the wings melt. But the young Icarus, in his excitement to experience flight, does not heed that warning, and tragically plunges to his death in the Aegean Sea. Page 112. Anyone who has ever read the myth is overwhelmed by the dramatic description of Icarus' fall. What an unforgettable event it must have been to all those who witnessed it. One would presume from the name of the painting that its focus would be squarely upon Icarus. But Bruegel, in a brilliant decision to reevaluate the event and its impact, offers a painting where Icarus is not only not at the center of the canvas, as one would expect, he is almost absent from the picture entirely. All one can see of him is his legs sticking out of the water under the ship at the lower right of the painting. The majority of the characters are common folk engaged in their daily activities, plowing, shepherding, fishing, and traveling on ships, with not one of them turning a head or even sufficiently distracted from his chores to observe what was described in the myth as an almost earth-shattering event that nobody could have missed. One of the messages of this painting is that it is possible for people to not be aware of the suffering in their midst because they are simply too involved in their day-to-day lives. How many of us truly give the attention we should to such matters? Bruegel, I surmise, may even have had a darker, harder, and more accusative message than this, if one considers that, as Ovid tells the tale, he lived 43 before the Common Era to 17 into the Common Era, as he tells the tale, the laborers in the painting actually saw father and son in flight. In his, and that's from Metamorphoses, Book 8, the Klein version. In his version of the narrative, of Ovid, that's how it's pronounced in English today, but in Latin, Ovid. In his version of the narrative, what we now see in the painting is not merely a lack of awareness of human suffering, but a purposeful turning away, even as it occurred right before their very eyes. Indeed, such is the understanding of that the poet W.H. Auden conveyed in his poem, Musée des Beaux-Arts, the Museum of Fine Arts, is the name of his poem, upon viewing the painting while visiting Brussels, slightly abbreviated, quote, "About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him, it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on." The footnote. Auden's interpretation also had a specific application. It has not been lost among those who have analyzed the poem that he wrote these words in December of 1938, only months after Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. Europe, having seen this unprovoked injustice, largely turns away from its responsibilities by sacrificing the country to appease the Nazi regime. Of course, Hitler was not satisfied, as it was hoped he would be, and the eventual result was World War II, resulting in the greatest atrocities in the history of mankind. The powerful message of the painting and the poem is still relevant to the Russian invasion of Ukraine in our time.
Wow.
A chaplain must take care to absorb Bruegel's teaching. It is possible for one to become normalized to tragedy and to simply go about his business without sufficient attention being offered to the one who has fallen, who is suffering, who is in need. In a hospital, there are scores of patients who must endure surgeries every day, and just as many who enter the emergency room, not to mention countless others who are in hospital beds. Each must be seen, heard, and treated with sensitivity. Each deserves an opportunity for pastoral care without seemingly disappearing from the landscape. As a chaplain, I have pledged to myself not to reenact Bruegel's vision of the fall of Icarus. And you know where I think, this is me now speaking, you know where I think we have a parade example of the painting, the fall of Icarus, of people just being very, very not into it, not concerned, going about their business? Blood donations. Somebody else will take care of that. Some schmo out there, some sucker, he'll roll up his sleeve, he'll take a needle, he'll provide the blood that I might need in the future. Somebody else will do that. And they go about their business. And they just ignore the constant need for whole blood, platelets, leukocytes, red cells, everything. It's incredible. Somebody else will take care of it until they themselves need it. And I see it happening in this community. This one needed blood. That one needed blood. There's slowly becoming an awareness that we all need the blood in the local blood bank. And if we don't give, shame on us. Because who should give? Others should give, and we're going to process it, and we're going to be productive from it. We're going to benefit from it. Not how a Jew should be. Page 115, a house of prayer for all peoples. Isaiah chapter 56, verse 7. Ki beisi beis tefila yikarei. Because my house will be called a house of prayer for all people. Wow. You wouldn't have thought that, by the way. Thus the Nebbi told you that. You'd never think that the Beis HaMikdash, which is going to be rebuilt, may it come soon, may it come today, in Jerusalem, that that's going to be considered by God a house of prayer for all people. Beis tefila l'chol ha'amim. Ki beisi beis. It's incredible. It's incredible. Not going to be uniquely a Jewish house, it seems. It's going to be a house for all peoples, and they'll all stream, as the Navi said. We're learning Isaiah right now in a Tanakh class. You should be part of it. The Naharu Elav, they'll all stream. They'll all flow like a river to the land of Israel. All the nations of the world will get on planes and go to Israel to be taught what the Almighty God wants. After a few weeks of daily huddles, I raised an issue I knew was likely to create controversy. It was an issue I could never have raised without the high level of comfort that had been established in the group, as had been revealed through the previous agreement about prayer. The hospital was in the midst of refurbishing its chapel. The chapel featured a large cross, front and center, in its midst. It was, for all intents and purposes, a church, which had been deemed as such since its founding. I found this problematic. I offered my arguments in such a way that the focus was not on the cross per se, but on the hospital's obligation to its constituency. First, this was inconsistent with the hospital's own mission. The Christ Hospital was indeed, by virtue of its historical origins, properly defined as a Christian hospital. But it had long since identified itself, as we have stated previously, as non-denominational, claiming to serve people of all faiths equally. Second, as was already mentioned, the philosophy of chaplaincy is inclusive and seeks to serve all of its patients, their families, and staff in a comfortable setting. While it was true that the overwhelming majority of the hospital constituency was associated with a branch of Christianity, the current situation meant that Jews, Muslims, and others were excluded from the one place in the hospital set aside for prayer. To make myself clear, I would have objected in accordance with this line of reasoning if it was decided to erect a synagogue as the one prayer space as well. The matter was discussed respectfully and honestly in the huddle and in many following huddles. While some were incredibly supportive of my critique, I sensed discomfort in others with making such a change to an area connected so strongly to the history of the hospital, which I could fully understand. By the way, Shmuel Plotzker, I'm now speaking. When you go to Jewish hospitals, at Jewish, they have a prayer room, and it's basically a shul. The truth of the matter is it's set up like and looks like a synagogue. It has all the trappings of a Jewish prayer room. If I recall correctly, I think that there's an Aron Kodesh in the front. There are Hebrew books all over the place, the Siddurim. And a Jew could feel comfortable, I think, praying in that room. If I'm not mistaken, this is my recollection of it. And there's also, at the same time, there's also like a room set aside where it's a completely non-denominational, where anybody could feel comfortable going in there, because there's really basically nothing in that room. It's just a room on the side of this chapel space, and anybody could go in there and pray. And I think I had times that I had to go pray over there. I don't remember if I was inside the... Yeah, I got to go back there and check it out. Check out that chapel room. I really do. At all events, we're talking about Christ Hospital. We continue. At one point, I asked our director of pastoral care if I might present my views in a letter to the hospital leadership, which he encouraged. In so doing, I joined together with a Muslim colleague who was the hospital's head of anesthesiology and who was fully sympathetic to my cause. The leadership informed the director in response to our letter that it was in his hands to make this decision as he held the authority over the chapel and its use. He decided objectively, sensitively, and courageously, in my opinion, the arguments to remove the cross as a permanent fixture in the chapel were valid. I was ecstatic, but all was not done. Page 117. The pastoral team met in the chapel to have a look at the new wallpaper that was to adorn its walls. The wallpaper was made up of crosses. To be sure, it doesn't seem to end Forever Ball. It's like a TV show or a movie. The wallpaper is made up of crosses. To be sure, a member of the Christian faith would be aware that the crosses were more like plus signs as opposed to the usual symbol, with the horizontal line set upward from the center toward the top. But anyone of another faith would see them as crosses. My heart sank, but I remained firm and voiced my objection. It was decided the next day that this would not achieve the desired goal of the project, which was inclusivity, and the design was rejected with another put in place. When the new chapel was dedicated, it was dedicated as a place of prayer for all people. As for the cross and other ritual items that were required for a particular service, they would be brought into the chapel before each service and removed thereafter. I experienced great spiritual satisfaction that all could now comfortably serve God in this sacred space. The great Jewish thinker Maimonides has stated, quote, "Every single person from all the inhabitants of the world whose spirit guides him and whose intellect leads him to understand, to separate himself and to stand before God, to serve him and worship him, to know God and walk morally as God created him, and who removes from his neck the many calculations that men have sought, he is sanctified with the greatest holiness, holy of holies, Kodesh HaKadoshim, and God will be his portion and his inheritance forever and ever." See the Mishneh Torah, the laws of the sabbatical and jubilee years, chapter 13. He concludes, "While I was aware of Maimonides' broad universal perspective throughout my life, it was only after I became a chaplain that I noted firsthand and on a daily basis that such spirituality both exists and flourishes in the minds, hearts, and souls of the righteous and wise of other faiths besides my own, a truth confirmed to me throughout the many encounters I had with patients and staff, but which was most palatable in that special and unforgettable gathering, the huddle." Chapter 5, Humanly Holy. Page 121, The Source of Holiness. Here's a prayer from Reb Simcha Bunim of Pesitka, who lived 1765 to 1827. "Holiness is not found in the human being in essence unless he sanctifies himself. According to his preparation for holiness, so the fullness comes upon him from on high. A person does not acquire holiness while inside his mother. He is not holy from the womb, but has to labor from the very day he comes into the air of the world." Rav Simcha Bunim, found in Michael Rosen's book, The Quest for Authenticity. Page 122, Greater Than Angels. Our goal in life should be to become, quote, humanly holy. For instance, see Exodus 23, and see the comments of the Kutzker Rebbe in Amud HaEmet, a work in Hebrew, page 26. Our goal in life should be to become humanly holy, for angels are not nearly on the level of holiness to which a human being can ascend. Yes, we humans have our challenges, our failings, our idiosyncrasies that often distract us from our missions, but it is precisely because angels have no such challenges that when we overcome those elements of interference, we are all the more beloved to God over beings who are merely programmed to follow his word without question. Angels can neither learn from their mistakes, nor can they become better as a result of evaluating and changing their thoughts or actions. But more than this, a great scholar from generations past commented, this is the Chassam Sofer, "What will a person accomplish by becoming as holy as the angels? God does not need any more angels up above. He has myriads of angels, and he creates new angels on a daily basis. God needs people to influence and inspire others toward the love of God. He needs them here on earth to prevent the downfall of civilization. That's the Chasam Sofer in his introduction to Yoredeya. In the words of Rabbi Soloveitchik, quote, holiness means the holiness of earthly, here and now. God does not wish to hand over his Torah to the ministering angels, the denizens of a transcendent world. Only against the concrete empirical background of the world can the Torah be implemented. Find that in Halachic Man, page 33 to 34. He continues, Rabbi Soloveitchik, holiness does not wink at us from beyond, like some mysterious star that sparkles in the distant heavens, but appears in our actual, very real lives. Also from Halachic Man. If not higher, page 124. A beautiful story by the author I.L. Peretz, who lived 1852 to 1915, portrays this idea in a most wonderful way. The story tells of a small village whose townsfolk are preparing for the Jewish high holidays. One traditional ritual at that time is the recitation of slichos, special prayers of forgiveness, which take place before dawn. The people who attend the service are surprised that on Fridays, their rabbi is not in attendance for this important gathering. Where could he be? Why is he absent while everyone else is petitioning God for mercy? The townsfolk know that their rabbi is a righteous and holy individual, and surely he would not miss this occasion without cause. They reason, therefore, that it can only be that the rabbi ascends to heaven every morning while they are in prayer to try to intercede on their behalf. One of the town citizens, however, who has his doubts, decides he's going to find out for himself. He arises even earlier than the others. He follows the rabbi, who has gone into the forest. There, he sees the rabbi chop wood and lug it to a small shack. Inside the shack is an old woman who is impoverished and shivering under the covers. The rabbi puts the wood into the stove and allows the woman to have heat for the day. He then returns to the town. The man who has followed the rabbi watches in amazement as he carries out this incredible act of loving kindness, done quietly and without fanfare, with purity of heart and love for a fellow human being. Upon the man's return, he becomes a disciple of the rabbi. And should he hear another speak of how the rabbi has again been ascending to heaven to intervene on behalf of his people, he responds quietly, heaven, if not higher. God was in the room. Page 126. How do I relate to a patient as I walk into his room? One of my childhood teachers, with whom I remained close my entire life, was Rabbi Abraham Magentz, who lived 1920 to 2003. Born in Poland, he witnessed anti-Semitism and destruction all around him as a young man. He once told me that when he walked the streets, at times there were bodies everywhere, and he just continued to walk, even as he stepped over them, as if there were nothing. And yet, despite these and other tragedies he experienced, I vividly remember he would offer a friendly hello and smile to every person he encountered with great gusto and sincerity. A person who adhered to no organized religion once remarked to me, when Rabbi Magentz says hello to you, there are beams of light that shine from his face. In some way, even when I was a youngster, he seemed more genuine than anyone I had ever known. When I was about 17 years old, I witnessed an occurrence with Rabbi Magentz, which I would never forget. On a particular Sabbath day, Saturday, following the prayer services at Congregation B'nai Amunah, a conservative congregation in St. Louis, where I was raised, a luncheon was held for graduating students of the religious school, as well as for their families. I was one of those students. We, the students, requested that Rabbi Magentz, whose small Orthodox synagogue was just around the corner from our much larger congregation, speak at the luncheon. He was more than happy to oblige.
In the middle of a speech, a man walked in off the street, dirty, smelly, and in shabby clothing. He entered the back of the auditorium and in a loud voice asked for some food. Some congregants quickly motioned to him to get out, but he persisted. He was given some rolls to satisfy him, but he still would not leave. "I'm starving," the man screamed. "I need a meal, not a few rolls." By this time, the noise had become a major distraction. Some men took hold of his arms to physically escort him out of the auditorium, but he continued to cry out. Reverend McGinn says, "What's going on there?" A congregant responded, "It's okay, Rabbi. We gave this fellow some rolls, but he refuses to leave. He insists on a full meal. We'll take him out of here." The beggar says, "I am hungry, Rabbi. I haven't had a good meal in weeks. I need more than just a few rolls." The rabbi says, "If the man is hungry, we must feed him. Let him stay. Give him a full meal. In fact, put him at my table. Seat him right here next to me." A deafening silence suddenly fell over the room as the man walked before everybody to the head table and sat with the rabbi for the remainder of the speech and the meal. I don't believe I ever saw a greater act of holiness in my life than that moment of human kindness. I confess that I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever of the topic of the speech the rabbi delivered that day. Actions speak louder than words. Many years later, I reminded an acquaintance who had witnessed this with me and the over 100 others in the room of the story. His response was memorable. No one who was present at that gathering could ever forget it. A profoundly simple but incredibly powerful act of loving kindness. Everyone knew God was in the room on that day. Like many of the most spiritual moments I have experienced in my life, this occurrence was completely unexpected. We did not plan for it. We could not have planned for it. Encounters with God can and often do take place in our lives when we are least expecting them. Still, I firmly believe that the more one is aware of such possibilities, the more one will be open to God's presence in all circumstances. Almost 20 years later, I reminded Reverend McGinnis of the story of that man off the street who he had placed at the head table next to him. He responded that he could not even recall such an occurrence. I could not believe it. "What?" I asked incredibly. "Every person who was in that room will never forget it. How could you not remember it?" And then, in what was for me another unforgettable moment, he responded with complete humility and simplicity, "Things like that happen to me all the time. I really don't remember them." This statement stunned me almost as much as the initial story. It seems such random acts of love and kindness, so incredible to us, were daily events for Rabbi McGinnis. I was honored to retell the above story as the guest speaker upon the occasion of Rabbi McGinnis's 80th birthday. 3 years later, I related it once more at his funeral. After the eulogy, a man approached me who seemed unusual and off. With tears in his eyes, he said, "You know, Rabbi, I am a lonely person because I am an unusual person. I know that. Nobody, I mean nobody, cares about me. But Rabbi McGinnis cared about me. He would pick me up in his car and take me out to dinner every week. Every week! And then after dinner, he sat with me for an hour or so and we would talk. It was so nice of him. Who am I going to speak to now?" Indeed, Rabbi McGinnis's son described his father in the following way. Quote, "My father was the rabbi for all of the invisible people in this world. He was a rabbi who welcomed the unusual person. He was a rabbi who befriended the lonely person." End quote. We often consider the love of people who are different than we are to be extraordinary. For Reverend McGinnis, it was completely natural, unforced, and a joyous part of existence. When I enter a room, I try to view the patient as Rabbi McGinnis would, beloved of God, created in his image, and blessed with dignity, no matter what I perceive through his clothing or his outer demeanor. Following in his footsteps, I greet every person in the hospital with a warm smile and hello. Staff, patients, visitors, no exceptions. Small gestures such as these can make all the difference for the one who is the recipient of such kindnesses, as well as for the one who bestows them. Such small kindnesses within the reach of every one of us, performed over and over again, are the surest way for us to bring about the ultimate redemption of mankind. Rabbi without a name. Another aspect of holiness that is so powerful is anonymity. I was told that a rabbi was specifically requested for a certain visit. After walking into a room and speaking to the patient's wife, her husband was very weak at this point and could hardly speak, I naturally presumed she was Jewish. So do you attend a certain synagogue in town? Oh, we are not Jewish. We are Christian. Oh, I was told you specifically asked for a rabbi. That is correct. Do you mind if we speak in a private room about this? We went into a consultation room, and she proceeded to tell me her overwhelming story. My husband is dying. I have just been through a hard-fought battle with breast cancer. Other members of my family are also critically ill. I am afraid I just cannot hold it together anymore. She began to cry uncontrollably, and understandably so. How much pain and suffering can one person take? It was everywhere. We spoke. We prayed. She was obviously, from my assessment, a very strong woman who was not one to cry and seemed relieved she could release those deep inner feelings that had been penned up inside of her to someone who she trusted. But why did she trust me, a rabbi, over a chaplain of her own faith? After a while, she regained her composure and the visit began to wind down. But I just had to know the answer to that question. So if you do not mind my asking, why did you ask specifically for a rabbi? Well, you see, many years ago, maybe it was 10 years ago, at another local hospital, I had lost a close relative and was grieving heavily. The chaplain was called to help me with my grief, and as it happens, he was a rabbi. I see. Do you remember his name? No. Can you believe it? I cannot remember his name. What I do remember is that he was incredibly kind, sensitive, and patient, and was with me every step of the way as I grieved for my lost relative. It was for this reason I specifically requested a rabbi. After the rabbi who I spoke with, who was so comforting to me in the time of my need. This encounter is so informative of the meaning of the chaplaincy, and to a great degree of the meaning of life in general. The woman was of one faith, but did not hesitate in asking for a representative of another. She clearly understood the situation was such that it transcended the need for a figure of a particular denomination. Indeed, her previous experience confirmed this was so, and she was confident enough in her belief to try to recreate that setting once again. What touches me the most, however, is the fact that she did not remember the rabbi's name. And that is okay. When a person is doing God's work, it is enough that God knows what a person has done and that he knows your name. In fact, not only do others not need to know the author of the deed, but the power of that deed done quietly with no fanfare surrounding it and no name to which to connect to it makes the act all the more sacred and, yes, godly. There was once a great rabbi and teacher who raised many disciples and spiritual leaders to uphold Jewish ethical teachings. One of the students who went on to be a leading rabbi in his own right was once asked why this great scholar never wrote a book. He responded remarkably that he believed it was the wish of his teacher, after living out his years in God's service, that no one would know he had ever existed. A book would have interfered with that wish. As quoted by Rabbi Yonason Rosenblum on Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the comment of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was about Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel, known as the Alter of Slobodka. He did not want people to know that he even ever existed. This level of humility is difficult for many to understand. When I read this, I had to stop and think about it for a long time. I was in complete shock. After all, who doesn't want his name to remain after he is gone, so that he is remembered? But this rabbi understood that a person's legacy is not his name, but his good deeds. With that said, who really needs to remember a person so long as God remembers him? And when God remembers, it is forever. The Holy Beggar of Jerusalem, the last little mini chapter in this chapter. While I surely feel that I bring inspiration to the patients with whom I visit, it is possible that the inspiration I receive from them is even greater. I recall that I first learned this lesson long ago while on a trip to the Holy Land. While walking the streets of Jerusalem, a place where unexpected encounters with the holy seem to occur regularly, I passed a dirty, old, crippled man sitting on the ground in shabby clothing and holding his cup out for charity. I quickly reached into my pocket, grabbed some money, and gave it to him. As I hurried on my way, the man cried out to me. The beggar says, "Hey, mister, come back. Come back. I gave you some money already. I have to get going." "No, you don't understand. Come back here. Come back." "Oh, I understand quite well, my friend. What more do you need? What more do you want from me? I already put money in your cup. I put some money in your cup. I need to go. I tell you that you must come back. Please come back." "Okay," I was getting tired of the back and forth, and I returned to see what he wanted. "You see, my friend, just because I'm a cripple and have to beg for money every day in order to survive doesn't mean I'm only a taker. I'm also a giver. Please get down on your knees so I can reach you. Bend over and bow your head." I was a little unsure of what was coming next, but for some reason I followed his instructions. He then gently placed his hand on my head and said, "May God grant you a long life and endless inner peace. May he give you blessings from your children and from their offspring. And may your eyes see only good things throughout your days in this world." I slowly looked up from the ground at this crippled beggar in awe, except I no longer saw a shabby, dirty old man before me, but instead a holy person whom I had blindly overlooked. Truth be told, I did not want to lift my head up at all. I would have preferred that he continue with his words of blessing. "That's why you yelled at me to come back? So you could bless me?" "Yes. You see, even though I am a beggar, I am not a taker. I am a giver." "You are most definitely a giver. Thank you for that beautiful blessing." "Indeed, very few people have ever given me what I received that day on the holy streets of Jerusalem from that holy crippled beggar, a blessing that has endured and served me well until this very day. In the hospital, I offer blessings for the patients. There are times when they bless me as well, with the most exquisite poetic language that one could imagine. Some of these I have already noticed. Others are yet to come." I want to thank everybody for coming out today for book club. We just concluded chapters 4 and 5 of this most wonderful work, Wisdom from the House of Healing, Rabbi Hanan Balk. We're well on our way towards finishing it. We're about halfway through the book. It's an absolutely wonderful work. I really do love it. Please come on back next week for chapter 6, Creating Meaningful Relationships. And maybe even chapter 7, if we can do it. Wishing everybody only the best. God willing, see you tomorrow for Tanakh Tuesday. We couldn't meet on Tisha B'Av. Let's meet tomorrow as we continue our study of chapter 2. A most beautiful and uplifting chapter. You'll see why if you show up. Everybody have a great one. Zay Gezunt. Feel well and be safe. Shmuel Plotzker signing off now for Gelfand Synagogue, our School of Jewish Studies. We thank you, Mitch and Jake, for all you do at SheerEnjoyment.com. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.